Facebook.
You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. When the road looks rough ahead and you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed, your past, boy, you got a friend in me. Yeah, you got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. You got trouble, and I got them too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. We stick together, see it through, 'cause you've got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. Some other folks might be a little bit smarter than I am, big and stronger too, maybe, but none of them will ever love you the way I do. It's me and you, boy, and as the years go by, our friendship will never die. You're gonna see it's our destiny. You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me.
Hi there, I'm Michael Goldberg, and it's time for an hour of story and song. This week, celebrating the friend who's always there no matter what. The one who believes in you and gives you their best and brings out yours. I'm fortunate to have such a friend. She never judges me, or if she does, she's quick to forgive. She and I were up at Deer Lake Charlie's a couple of weeks ago. Lots of people outdoors listening to jug band music. And she gave joy to anyone who wanted to scratch her ears. You could see how much each person was getting out of this exchange. Their eyes as soft and loving as hers, both being flooded with those healing hormones, the oxytocin, the dopamine coursing through their blood. And of course, through mine too, just watching this exchange of love between strangers. So today on Stay Human, we're singing the praises of our dogs, starting with three poems, first from Ely. Here's Diane Korda.
When I finally understand Mustang Sally has been my muse all the while. Sally studies the steam rising from my teacup while she learns to be my creative muse. We sit on the bed together. The heater kicks on. Dust speckles float past her nose and she snaps to catch them, hoping for mosquito meat. She chews her toenails, gnaws on a deer tine, bites my sleeve as my hand takes pen across this tattered journal page. Rolling to her belly, Sally places her chin on my shins, her legs flat on a 40-year-old Pendleton blanket, which she nips like the ornery fairy tale dragon, piercing wool with her almost 2-year-old teeth. I scold, "Where's your bone?" Her brown eyes spark and ears point forward. She jauntily tilts her head. "I have more than one. Which do you mean?" Sunlight and silence make my thoughts fertile. For the third time, Sally dozes and runs through stormy dreams until I decide to follow. She travels the edges, where paths meet woods, where rivers meet silt. Her heartbeat echoes old woman stories of invisible edges, thin red lines that divide ordinary from sacred. Over and over, I write certain phrases, slightly altering them, until they appear like shaman chants, hidden on paper. Sally sleeps. Her front paw rests upon my ankle.
Thanks to Diane Korda. Her newest volume of poetry, Nighthawk Storyteller, is now available at DianeKorda.com. That's DianeKorda.com. Today's Stay Human is going to the dogs. When I told a friend of mine I was putting this hour together, he asked me to include something from poet Mary Oliver. She speaks dog, he said. From her collection, Dog Songs, The Poetry Teacher by Mary Oliver. The university gave me a new, elegant classroom to teach in. Only one thing, they said. You can't bring your dog. It's in my contract, I said. I had made sure of that. We bargained, and I moved to an old classroom in an old building, propped the door open, kept a bowl of water in the room. I could hear Ben, among other voices, barking, howling in the distance. Then they would all arrive. Ben, his pals, maybe an unknown dog or two, all of them thirsty and happy. They drank. They flung themselves down among the students. The students loved it. They all wrote thirsty, happy poems. Mary Oliver. One more poem today, this from Northern Minnesota poet Robert Jevney. He sent it to me with a note saying, not sure if this qualifies for the pet show because ultimately it's all about me, as most things are. Here's Robert Jevney.
When you start writing about your dog, our dog Bingo is a keen observer of chickadees, the local varieties of woodpeckers, of nuthatches, redpolls, and grosbeaks. She marks these late winter days draped over the arm of the couch, staring out the window, her head twitching in small increments after every flitting thing at the feeder. For me, this marks the official end of the pretense that I have anything to write about, leaving this poem, then, to be more about our other dog, Pal, who was born with bad hips and, try as he might with one hind leg stretched forward, cannot quite reach his ear to scratch it.
Little dog music for you from Dave Grisman. Our first storyteller today is Dave Chase.
The sign at the end of the farm driveway said, free puppies. Hey, let's take a look. The big mama dog of indeterminate breed was laying there nursing her litter. The biggest, a shaggy white ball of fur, came waddling over and seemed to say, about time. Took you long enough. Let's go home. So we did. Took about that long. He didn't have a name for a long time. Finally, father-in-law Norm, noticing his proclivity for humping on anything and anyone that he get his legs around, started calling him Pumper. The name stuck. Pumper was a handsome dog. Looked like a Springer Spaniel, but he was far bigger than any Springer. He was a happy dog. He seemed to find everything funny. He loved to play. For instance, he'd play with the kids at the playground. He'd climb the ladder on the slippery slide, then slide down over and over and over. But what he really loved and was born for was hunting. But I was not a hunter. I was a city kid. My dad didn't hunt, and growing up, I didn't know anyone who did. But I inherited a shotgun from Uncle John, a Winchester Model 12. So it was time I learned. Pumper knew what to do, even if I didn't, and he was a good teacher. He couldn't teach me how to shoot, however, and that caused him no end of frustration. If we hunted with someone else and knocked down a bird, Pumper would bring it back and give it to the other guy. He'd figure he was the one that shot it. Like I said, he was a smart dog. We were hunting with two other guys, walking down a road built through a slough with a deep ditch with steep sides on both sides of the road. Pumper stopped and pointed down into the ditch. He was in a classic pointer pose, nose pointed, front leg lifted, tail straight out and back. I wondered, how did he learn to do that? We three hunters spread out, guns up, safeties off. Ready? Yep. Get him up. Pumper leaped into the ditch. Up jumped a cock pheasant. Bam, bam, bam. That pheasant just kept flying. Missed. We all missed. Pumper came back up onto the road, and we walked on farther. Again, Pumper stopped. Pointed. Again, guns up. Safeties off. You ready? Yep. Get him up. Again, Pumper jumped into the ditch. Up jumped another cock pheasant. Bam, bam, bam. Again, that pheasant just kept flying. We all missed. Again, Pumper came back up onto the road. We walked on farther. Again, Pumper stopped, pointed. Again, guns up, safety's off. Ready? Yep, get him up. Again, dog leaped, pheasant flew. Bam, bam, bam. Missed again. But then that silly bird turned around and flew right back across in front of us, right in front of our guns. Bam, 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 bam. That bird just kept on flying. One feather, one single feather came floating down. Pumper came back up onto the road, watched that lone feather fall and gave us a look, such a look, and turned and trotted back to the truck. He quit, disgusted. I thought that was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. I laughed, and I laughed, and I laughed. I loved that dog. As much as Pumper loved pheasant hunting, he loved hunting ducks even more. He was a powerful swimmer, and he almost always found his duck. One opening day, we went out with Johnny Meadows. He was our local great hunter. He knew of Pumper's reputation and wanted to hunt with him. I was thrilled and flattered, of course. We hunted from our canoe. We'd go out into Mud Lake and find one of the many floating bogs, throw out a piece of plywood onto the bog, step out onto the plywood, and drag the canoe up onto the bog. It gave us a good blind. It was stable, comfortable to sit in, and after bending the reeds over the side of the canoe, pretty well camouflaged. This day did not go well. Pumper didn't live up to his reputation, not even close. Driving home, I had a heart-to-heart talk with him, something like, "Pumper, I was really disappointed with you today. I can't imagine what Johnny thought, but he still wants to hunt with us tomorrow. But you got to do better. Otherwise, maybe we'll just forget about duck hunting this year." Well, the next morning, we were out in our canoe blind well before dawn. Just as there was light enough to see, a flock of teal flew over. Johnny knocked one down. Pumper immediately splashed into the water off to retrieve that duck. So far, so good. But Pumper didn't come back. We waited, and we waited. I started to worry. What could have happened? Could he have gotten tangled in some marsh grass somehow? Could a big snapper have grabbed him and pulled him under? It'd never taken him this long to retrieve a duck. But then, by and by, I heard him splashing and huffing and puffing. He crawled up onto the bog. He had a duck in his mouth. He jumped into the canoe and gave it to Johnny. Of course. Johnny said, "That's a coot." He threw it into the air. The coot flew away. I knew what happened. Pumper couldn't find the teal. This is understandable because Mud Lake was a real mess of reeds and weeds and bogs and just way too many hiding places for a crippled teal. But Pumper, he knew he had to bring something back. So he caught a coot. The coot probably dived to escape, but Pumper would have gone right down after it. Like I said, he was a really good water dog. We lived in Portland, Oregon for a time, and Pumper loved the ocean. Most of the coast in Oregon is open to the public, and it was only a couple hours' drive, so we went there often. There are all sorts of fun things for a dog to do, but the most fun thing of all is playing in the waves. Of course, he'd get soaked in salt water, so I'd need to get that washed out. On the way home, we'd stop at one of the streams coming down from the coastal mountains and go for a swim. Well, Pumper would swim, not me. This one particular day, the stream was in flood, so it was more of a river, really full of rapids and white water. We found a place with a big eddy of quiet water, and I threw a stick for Pumper to get. I threw it just a bit too far. Pumper got the stick, but the current got Pumper, and down the river they went. I ran along the river as Pumper fought the current. The river curved away from me, so the fastest current was on my side, and Pumper wasn't going to be able to get to me before he'd be swept into a steep-sided, rocky canyon. I was about to lose my dog. I was in a panic, but helpless. Luckily, there was a reverse eddy on the other side of the river, so Pumper was able to get out of the river on that side. Well, Pumper was on one side. I was on the other, with a raging river between us. There was only a short distance before the river was constricted by the canyon walls. There was no way Pumper could survive that terrible turbulence. We had a problem. A horrible problem. Not to worry. Pumper, the wonder dog, figured it out. He judged the current, figured the angles, did the math. He ran way upstream, jumped in and swam across and landed back where we started, but still had that stick in his mouth. Like I said, he was a smart dog.
Thanks to Dave Chase. He often stops by at Stay Human when he's up north. I hope that we can get him at one of our live storytelling events one of these days. We have one coming up next week, Saturday night at 7 o'clock, September 20th, at Clocko Brewing in Grand Rapids. It's going to be a great evening featuring nationally known storyteller Lauren Neamey. He's got something going called the American School of Storytelling, and he's been up in Grand Rapids working with me and several of the Stay Human contributors. We're putting on a show to practice what he preaches, the authentic voice. Hope you can join us for that. That's Saturday the 20th at 7 p.m. Our next teller on today's show has participated in several of the storytelling concerts and open mics that we've held at Clocko Brewing. That's where she told us about Dusty. Here's Janet Jiskra.
Back when we lived in Forest Park, Illinois. Now, Don was renting a coach house in the suburb of Forest Park, and I needed a place to live, so I moved in with him. And I had decided that now that I was an adult, I had always wanted a dog. So we were going to get a dog. Like you, we did some research and we decided we wanted to get a Cairn Terrier. And if you're not familiar with that, that is Toto from The Wizard of Oz. We needed a small dog. This apartment was about four rooms. And so we got our little Cairn Terrier. We named him Dusty. So at the time, Don was still working at a movie theater, so he would work until about midnight. And I was in college, and I always took morning classes. So I would get up early in the morning, and he would be with the dog while I was in school. And then when he would go to work in the evenings, I would be home. So it was a perfect life for our little dog. So one morning, I got up early, trying to be quiet to not wake Don up. He'd had a late show the night before. And I went downstairs and started my shower. And when I take my glasses off, I can't see much of anything. So I don't know why, Michael, but my stories always seem to involve a shower. So I got into the shower and I looked down and I could see something brown was in the shower with me. And I knew it was too big to be a spider. So I reached out, grabbed my glasses, put them on and looked down and it was a mouse. A mouse was in the bathtub with me. So I jumped out of the shower, put my robe back on, ran upstairs to the bedroom and I woke Don up. Don, there's a mouse in the bathtub. I don't know why it freaked me out so much. I've seen mice before. So his sleepy response, in case you don't know, Cairn Terriers are ratters. And he said, well, pick Dusty up and throw him in the bathtub and see what he does. And I was like, seriously? Are you kidding me? So he followed me downstairs. He's like, yes, I am serious. Put Dusty in the bathtub. So I picked Dusty up, tossed him in the tub, which was not his favorite place to be. But he saw that there was a mouse. And the mouse saw that there was a dog. So the mouse went down the drain. And now I'm thinking, great, we're renting this place. This mouse is going to be dead in the drain, and it's going to cause plumbing problems. So Don's response was, we'll turn the hot water on. Dusty, meanwhile, was staring at that drain. He wasn't going to take his eyes off of that. So we turned the water on, and up popped the mouse. Jump went Dusty and glommed onto that mouse. And he quickly turned his head, and that was it. The mouse was dispatched. Dusty came over to the edge of the tub, popped his little front paws on the edge of the tub, and looked at us with this mouse in its mouth, the tail hanging out like a piece of spaghetti, as if to say, look at me. I'm the king of the hill here. And we were clapping and applauding and saying, what a good dog, what a good dog. And then I thought, okay, now give me the mouse, with my hands outstretched. And with disdain, Dusty looked at me, popped his head backwards, and swallowed that mouse whole. And I think that is why I was never able to sustain dominance over this dog. He was the alpha in our little household for the rest of his existence.
Thanks to Janet Jisbra.
It's him or me, that's what he said. But I can't choose between a vegan and a pothead. So I chose you because you're sweet. And you give me lots of loving, and you eat meat. Came my only man of the hour. You never lie, and you don't cheat, and you don't have any baggage tied to your forefeet. Do I deserve to be the one who will feed you breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and take you to the park at dawn? Will you really be my only man of the hour?
Jones with Man of the Hour. Coming up later in this hour, Marsh Muirhead tells the tale of Jack the Dog and Matthew Miltich with a piece he calls Paw Prints. You're tuned to KAXE KBXE, radio that's people-powered and dog-friendly. One of the things that makes this community enterprise so great is that it's open to everyone. You don't have to be a dog person. You can stay human with a cat instead. Here's Grand Rapids writer Rebecca Zemanski.
I didn't know it the whole time, but for 21 years, the most stable thing in my life was my kitten, Antonia Katrina. We adopted Tony and her brother, Graylo, sometime around my brother's second birthday at the end of the muggy Kansas summer. The Humane Society shelter estimated they were a few weeks old, and I think we had to wait a week or so before bringing them home. They were two of three siblings, and I'll always wish I'd been more persuasive about bringing the third one home, too. I still feel slightly guilty for breaking up the set and leaving the gray and white one alone to an uncertain fate. I don't remember why I was so attached to the name Tony, but when our family friend Alex told me I couldn't name a girl cat with a boy's name, I dug in my heels. My mother said to name her Antonia and call her Tony for short. She, an English teacher, was thinking of Willa Cather's My Antonia, but something got lost in translation when it came to how I spelled the first title I gave the tiny gray, white, and sandy swirled kitten with pink padded paws. Over the years, including an obsessive Russian history phase, Antonia's name got longer and longer to reflect how we were both growing up together. Antonia Katrina Sosia Gabriella Jane Dylan Nikolovna. They started out life in our four-bedroom bi-level confined to a laundry room each night with their food, water, and litter box, and in a castle made of empty Kleenex boxes. During the day, they definitely had their adventures. I have a scar just to the right of the center of my chest from carrying Graylo down the upstairs hall when my mother suddenly turned on the vacuum cleaner, always hated by both kittens, and he scrambled to escape over my shoulder. My brother heard that mother cats carried kittens by the neck. But again, something was lost in translation, and the first couple times we found him heartily running at full speed up and down the hall with one hanging from each hand, we were nearly as horrified as the terrorized kittens. A family story goes that a neighbor rang the front door to bring my brother home and told my startled mom that he had been found in his wagon in the middle of the street outside our house where I left him because I ran back to get the kittens who escaped out the open front door. It seems plain to me even now that while I should have gone back and retrieved him once the kittens were safely indoors, prioritizing them was the right choice. There was hardly any traffic on our street anyway. It was not an assassination attempt against the shiny challenger for my parents' affections. My mother also recounts opening the laundry room door one morning to find a dead mouse in one corner and the kittens cowering together in the opposite one, at which point my father, who may have never been fully on board to begin with, apparently declared them useless at their primary function of rodent control. And so to the kittens, my father was the indifferent one, my exuberant brother was the one who inspired quaking terror, my mother was the one who thanklessly advocated for their very adoption and then potty trained them, and I was the amazing one who brought them food. As they grew bigger, we left the door open and put a baby gate at the bottom of the basement stairs, and finally they had possession of the whole house to explore in private while we were all tucked out of the way in bed. After about a year, my mother lost patience with Graylo's enthusiastic territorial marking, which was especially bad in the basement. He also increasingly bullied Tony, who remained as small as possible because he was hogging their food. Arrangements were made for him to go to the farm, a real one owned by family friends who lived outside of town, and along with having two children and a host of outdoor pets, grew vegetables and flowers for market. I was in full support of this plan because he would have many friends, big adventures, and I would go to visit often over the next few years. Up to this point, we hadn't seen much of Tony. Graylo frequently dominated the room with his personality, but Tony was usually retrieved from under bookshelves, coffee tables, or couches, or even inside chairs. While she was always cautious and easily startled, she began to bloom once Graylo moved. She curled up with me when I read on the couch, sat with me while I did homework to my mom's approval at the dining room table, and perched on me while I sprawled on my belly with books and papers strewn across the living room floor to my mother's despair. She came when I called her, and even if I spent too long in the kitchen, when I didn't, out of the hope that I might be making tuna melts or tuna salad sandwiches. She'd watch from the bed, table, or windowsills when I shut myself up in my room to play out imaginary worlds with Legos. I picked out names for most of the people, all 21 horses and any other animals, and then absorbed appropriately non-sized Lego figures like dolphins and penguins, then acted out epic adventures and sometimes wrote pieces of them down. At night, she'd perch on my knees or hips, her paws demurely folded, a comfortable, familiar weight that I missed at slumber parties or summer camp. When I was in elementary school and junior high, she listened to mixtape after mixtape that I laboriously created by crouching in the kitchen doorway with my ears pressed against the speaker of the radio so my mom wouldn't be bothered by the volume of the sounds she found annoying while she cooked or grated, my finger poised on the tape deck's record button to be ready when the song I knew came on. I transferred schools multiple times as my parents sought to balance healthy classroom environments with challenging material, switched choirs as I grew older, soccer teams reformed nearly every season. So there was a lot of social starting over. While I struggled to make friends each time, most would drift away with the next transition. But at every rough patch or setback, waiting for me at the foot of my bed, stability was curled up and purring loudly.
Thanks to Rebecca Zemanski.
Well, little lady, let me elucidate here. Everybody wants to be a cat, because a cat's the only cat who knows where it's at.
Tell me, everybody's picking up on that feline beat, because everything else is obsolete. A square with a horn makes you wish you weren't born
every time he plays.
But with a square in the act, you can set music back
to the game and days of jumbles.
I've heard some corny birds who tried to sing.
Still, a cat's the only cat who knows how to swing.
Who wants to dick long head dick and stuff like that?
When everybody wants to be a cat. A square with a horn makes you wish you weren't born every time he plays. Oh, a rinky-tinky-dinky with a square in the act. You can set music back to the caveman days.
Oh, a rinky-tinky-tinky.
Yes, everybody wants to be a cat, because a cat's the only cat who knows where it's at. When playing jazz, you always has a welcome mat. Everybody digs a swinging cat.
It's Stay Human, our weekly mix of words and music, and today we're staying human with the help of the non-humans in our families. Here's a tip for how to find a lost cat from storyteller Carol Hepikoski.
I thought the little calico kitten was a female and named her Luna, but then she turned out to be a he and the name changed to Lunas, an adorable little kitten. He liked to eat zucchini and loved to jump around the cabin at 5 o'clock in the morning, jumping on the bed, then racing around the living room and jumping from couch to chair to chair. We were grateful when he outgrew that. As a little one, Lunas was loving, but also a bit shy around strangers. Whenever someone came to visit, he'd crawl into the bed under the covers. I knew he was a smart cat, but then I really knew he was smart when he taught himself to pee in the toilet. I'm thinking he learned that by watching women in the bathroom. A few years on, we moved to St. Paul. By this time, we had another calico kitten, this one with a very loud purr. So he was named Harley after the motorcycle. When we first moved to the city, we didn't let the cats out for 6 or 8 weeks, or maybe it was longer. But then one evening, as we were saying goodbye to an old friend, Luna somehow snuck down the stairs and out the door. It was probably an hour or more before we realized he was gone, and we went out walking around the neighborhood calling, "Lunas, Lunas." But all in vain. Days passed. We put up flyers. We walked the neighborhood asking people if they'd seen him, but to no avail. I remember one rainy February day when I walked around the neighborhood in tears, calling for Lunas. Over 2 weeks had passed, but we still walked and called for Lunas every day. One evening, we were getting ready to go out to see a Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis performance. While I was getting ready, John thought that maybe the reason Lunas was lost because he didn't know which house was ours. So in this fenceless urban backyard, John took a pee, thinking that it might be a familiar smell, and smells are important to felines. And wouldn't you know it, when we returned home that evening, there was Lunas. He'd lost several pounds. He looked pretty unkempt and very tired, but he was alive and had found us. We were relieved, amazed, and very happy to see him. After bringing him upstairs, he scoped out the apartment, had a little food and water, and finally settled on the living room floor. His brother cat, young Harley, cautiously went over and laid down nearby, and then slowly stretched out his arm and gently laid a paw on Lunas's forearm. We often speculated about where Lunas had spent those weeks, wondering if he had started off on a trek north or was locked in someone's garage. Of course, we didn't know for sure that it was the smell of the urine that did the trick, but we thought maybe it was like a flashing, bright neon sign saying, "Home, home, home, Lunas, home." Lunas lived until he was 19, long after his city adventure, and in all the years since, whenever I've heard of someone trying to find a lost cat, I share this story, hoping it does the trick for them and brings their wandering beloved home once more.
My thanks to Carol Hepikoski and to John Berquist for leaving his mark. Here he is on the Button Box. Next, Bemidji writer Marsh Muirhead with Jack the Dog.
The tiny puppy, maybe 5 or 6 weeks old, still too young to have been taken from his litter, wherever that was handed off at the foot of Paul Bunyan at the lakefront from someone reported to be unhinged, a person holding the little guy in the air, calling out, "Anyone want a puppy?" The daughter of a friend of mine took the puppy and named it Paul in honor of the giant statue. Paul's rescuer was told by her parents that she couldn't keep the dog, but that another person, Marsh, could find it a good home, the home, of course, being mine. I already had a sweet 4-year-old golden retriever, Adele, and she could be a supportive stepsister to the puppy. Paul remained lethargic, sleepy for a few days. Who knows where he'd been, how fed and cared for, if at all, in the prior weeks. I slept with him, as I've always done with puppies, getting him up when he stirred, setting him out on the grass while he did his business. Within a few nights, he was potty trained, and he started to perk up, becoming quite alert, regarding me and his environment with fierce attention and curiosity, characteristics which he kept into adulthood, clues to his intelligence and genetics. He was clearly not a Paul. He was a dude. He knew Jack in the connotation of that expression. And so Jack he was, feisty, almost feral, yet trustingly bonded to me in short order. Who was this Jack, a dog who grew into 80 pounds of rock-hard muscularity, a dog who glided on well-knuckled feet, whose penetrating eyes were those of a wolf or cougar, accented by the facial markings of an Egyptian queen? I submitted a DNA test, which revealed that Jack was half Akita, with a significant contribution of Australian cattle dog and small percentages of two or three other breeds. Akitas, I learned, are one of the few dogs who can survive if released into the wild. The poet and writer Jim Harrison, author of Legends of the Fall, said that a dog can be the key to a deeper understanding of nature. And Jack was that. Always watching, scanning, nose and ears twitching, Jack knew more than we could ever know about the wild, about messages carried by the wind. Jack was a natural predator more than most dogs. He could catch birds, usually juncos, and I apologize for this, by waiting motionless by the feeder. He caught red squirrels, snakes, mice. He would jump into the river and chase flocks of geese paddling by. He once chased a black bear across the yard, about 5 feet behind him, while the retriever, Adele, 50 feet back, supervised, barking encouragement. Jack, so handsome and self-assured, liked girls. Girl dogs, girl and women people, they came to him, and he went to them at parties, at the vet office, among the neighbors. He was a favorite. He was fixed as soon as possible, and fortunately couldn't drive a car and didn't drink beer, but he did pick fights on male dogs on matters of territory. Once, when Adele and Jack and I were at the Wednesday night music on the lakefront, sitting amongst hundreds of people, many with their own dogs, Jack, with a twist of his head and a backward thrust, escaped from his collar and ran amok, speeding in mad circles through the crowd, amusing some, horrifying everyone else, especially after he bit into another dog who challenged him. The assembled villagers turned against Jack, kicking at him, screaming, and he raced back to me, crashing into my lap for protection. We were banished, both of us, quite publicly from the event. He played a game with Adele. If Adele was standing at some distance looking at Jack, he would crouch down low into a stalking position and advance in very slow motion as if unseen. Adele knew what he was up to, watching the whole time. When within 20 feet, Jack would launch himself, plowing into Adele, knocking her onto her back, nipping her a bit, then run in a few circles around her in celebration. Jack talked. Row, row, meant it was past supper time. A shushing sort of hiss meant he wanted to go outside. A normal bark in the middle of the night meant he detected the silent deer outside. A bark with an urgent whine meant bears were at the feeder. Jack liked to sleep on his back, legs splayed, his upper lip hanging down, exposing his fangs, often snoring. If you scratched his belly, the snoring would stop, and he would pretend to stay asleep. In the spring of 2024, Jack suddenly declined, became lethargic, wasn't himself. Visits to the vet involved tests, a complicated diagnosis, steroids, likely a lymphoma. Jack, we estimated, was born on June 1st, 2018, and died May 17th, 2024, curled up under the deck in the night. We had a funeral. Buried him out where he had chased the bear, killed the snake, just above the river where he had chased the geese. Adele looked for him for several days, searching into the woods where she might find him hunting, then lay down where his scent still lingered, near his grave. Jack was our best buddy, Adele's rambunctious little brother, and even among other dog lovers, Jack, they admit, was special, unique, a shooting star in his brief life, and now a legend.
Marsh Muirhead, here's one of my favorite dog songs from Curtis Salgado.
Wish I could read the minds of women. Wish I had gills for swimming. Wish I had movie star looks. I wish I knew every trick in the book. I'd like to feel first love again and be 20 years younger. But the greatest wish I want to come true, I want my dog to live longer. Wish I was the king of rock and roll. Wish I was cool and in the know. And I wish I'd rope blowing in the wind. I'd like to see my late mother again. I'd like to stop poverty, save this world from hunger. But the greatest wish, oh, I want to come through. I want my dog to live longer. I want my dog to live longer. 'Cause when he goes, I'll be blue. And if I had the power, oh, I'd have him live as long as me and you. 'Cause God's got a reason for everything. And in the Lord I trust. But this ain't right. God needs to see the light. 'Cause dogs don't live long enough. He cheers me up, oh, when I'm sad. He's the best friend I've ever had. And I don't care where his nose has been. I let him lick my face again and again. His love is unconditional. And that just makes me stronger. So the greatest wish I want to come true. I want my dog to live longer. Oh, the greatest wish I want to come true. I want my dog to live longer.
One more story for today's show. This from my neighbor Matthew Miltich, who has cared for and learned from many, many dogs over the years. Matthew Miltich with Paw Prints.
A winter night comes on. A hint of rose lies along the western horizon. I pull into the deserted parking lot west of the closed for the night coffee shop in town, park the pickup, and leave the engine running. I'll need heat from the blower to warm me as I wait to meet a woman named Rebecca, who's promised to rendezvous with me here. After a little wait, my cell phone sounds off. Her voice comes through the speaker. I'm 20 minutes out, she says, driving a white van. See you there. Winter or not, I feel the sweat of anticipation in the palms of my hands. I touch the envelope containing the cash I'll hand over to this unseen woman, with whom until now I've communicated only by email. On time to the minute, a white van cruises into the parking lot and comes to a stop alongside me. The driver nods to me, and as I climb down from my pickup, she steps out of her van, a slim woman with long blonde hair in her late 20s, perhaps. She smiles, says, "Thanks for meeting me here," then slides open the side door of the van. I smell, just immediately, the unmistakable but agreeable, at least to me, odor of young puppies. "He's been so good," the young woman says. "He never cried or whined the whole way." She steps up and in and then opens the door to one of a dozen dog crates that line the inside of the van. She lifts a squirming sand-colored puppy from the crate and hands him to me. "Here's your little guy," she says. I hear her Oklahoma home in her speech. "It's quite a job you have," I say, as holding in my arms the wiggling puppy lately from South Carolina, I hand her the envelope containing her pay. "Delivering puppies all over the country. Oh, I love it," she says. "How often do you do this?" "I'm on the road about 1 week out of every month," she says. "You have a place to stay tonight?" "Oh, I'll drive for at least a couple more hours yet. I sleep in the van. I have to get up at night to let the puppies out, you know, and take care of all their needs. Listen, I have to call my husband now," she says, "but thank you so much for meeting me here." And that's that. Squirming puppy in hand, I manage to get into the pickup and underway. I hope this little canine dude will settle in my lap and ride quietly, but no. I do my best to keep control of the truck as I head toward home through the winter night, but this pup, a field-bred English cocker, almost certainly the last bird dog pup I'll bring home during what's left of my already long life, wiggles and squirms all over the place. He's really little. I mean, just a tiny puppy, and one of a breed that is itself, by bird dog standards, diminutive. But already he's strong, a little athlete, and single-minded. It's as if suddenly I have a live rainbow trout flipping around on my lap, squirming out of my hands, some of the time trying, it seems, to take the wheel. I have 15 miles to drive to get us home. It goes on this way. 2 miles from my place, I stop to call her, literally, my future hunting partner, attach a check cord to his new little collar, and let him out to pee in the snow. The trout analogy holds. I have him on the line, but he puts up a fight. He pauses momentarily to pee, good, but resumes the tussle until, at last, I reel him in and drive us the rest of the way home. Then, as all my dogs have done, he enters our life at home, adding to it things both good and not so good, becoming part of it. I remember many another canine pal across a lifetime of keeping and loving dogs. First, there was Patty, my dad's Irish setter. I see him in blurred motion, a red streak, running flat out and full out, ears pinned back, as near to actual flight as any earthbound creature might be. Then came Quinto, Dad's next dog, a big golden retriever with a leonine presence who roamed our hometown as if he owned the place, which, in his way of knowing, he probably did. He certainly marked it so. My mine alone first ever canine hunting partner, Maya, was the first of a string of Labrador retrievers with whom I hunted for the next several decades. She came home with me as a seven-week-old pup when the mother of my two younger children was off in California for a visit. When the lady returned, she evinced she was none too pleased to have a new puppy in our home, which the puppy, as puppies will, seemed to sense. I witnessed one afternoon how that pup lay in wait, hiding behind the garage, for the lady of the house, as she walked out to get the day's mail, rushed her and knocked her off her pins. Within a couple of years, the human lady would depart, leaving the dog and me to raise my young children, but pup stayed by me until, grown old, she drew her final breath, simply went to sleep and didn't wake, faithful to the last. My big black lab Fielder, yellow-eyed and 95 pounds when grown, a gift as a puppy from a friend to whom I'd given a couple of pups, was sweet with children but hard-headed. He was inclined to hunt in his own way and devil take the hindmost. The first game I took over Fielder fell to my gun on an autumn afternoon in the woods when the pup was just 5 months old. He dashed into the hazel brush to seize the fallen bird, a ruffed grouse, trotted halfway back to me, then stopped to sit stock still, to think this thing over, or so it seemed to me. I called him and called him, but he stayed put. He looked me over, then looked over me, or maybe through me. It took some minutes for him to decide if that's what was happening inside his head, whether to eat his prize right there or to fetch it to hand, to give it up to me. Then at once he ran forward, sat before me to be praised, and delivered the bird to hand as I stroked his head. From that moment, for most of his 16 years and more, he was my good hunting partner and I his, each of us providing something to our hunts the other could not. I named the first of three border collies that came to live with us Whoop, which was my younger son's word when he was a wee boy for wolf. On my way home from the farm where I'd bought the three-month-old black and white pup, he got motion sick in the car and threw up in my lap. That was perhaps the only thing he ever did in my presence that didn't delight me in some way. Before I could get pup into the house, he was challenged by one of the barn cats, so mean he backed down even my big Labrador retriever. The little border collie immediately gave the cat what for, chased it up a tree, and that was that. Whoop was home. We had just one border collie at a time. After Whoop came Shorty, and after him, Tip. Each was different from the others, but all possessed a passion for herding, bred to it as their primary purpose in living. I once watched Shorty herd back and forth from one end of the pasture to the other, the two big Belgian mares I kept then. They weighed nearly 2,000 pounds each. Having had enough of him finally, one of the mares clipped Shorty on the forehead with the rear hoof and sent him rolling. He squealed and fled under the pasture fence into the woods. That's it then, I thought. He's been taught a lesson. After 10 minutes, he was back at it. His lesson, apparently, was not to leave the horses alone. No, but by his agility simply to avoid being kicked, which he never was again. He was just as happy, by the way, herding domestic ducks or chickens or even wind-blown leaves. I once made a mad dash across northern Wisconsin to get a Welsh Springer Spaniel puppy from a breeder in Eagle River, away on the east side of the state. I was to play string bass that evening at a gig in Duluth, Minnesota, about 2 hours southeast of my northern Minnesota home. I had my bass and all my gigging gear in the car, as well as a crate to house said pup, but I cut the time very close. The breeder showed me, as he said, the two males from the litter for sale, a couple of very pretty puppies, and quickly I chose the one I saw as most promising, then fled to the west and made it to my gig with 5 minutes to spare. I took pup out to walk between sets. The two of us arrived to my home in the wee small hours after the gig. For a week, I praised and petted and pampered that pup, for there are very few things prettier to my eyes than a new spaniel puppy. Then came an early morning phone call from the man, desperation in his voice, who'd sold me the dog. "It's a female I showed you," he pleaded, "promised to people in New Mexico. My mistake. If you'll exchange the little female you have for a male, I'll return $100 of what you paid me." I was astonished. I was just then outside with pup in arms, ready to put it on the grass so it could pee. I turned it over to look. Good God, the man was right. Pup was a she. How could I have missed that? "No, I won't meet you in Duluth," I told him, "but if you come get the puppy here and return my money, you can have her back. I'm done. You can keep the males." To tell you I was disappointed doesn't come near half to what I felt. In mid-afternoon, a pickup dog boxes lining its bed charged up my driveway. The breeder stepped out and onto my grass. "I'm really sorry," he said. "Listen, I brought the two males in case you might change your mind." He pulled a $100 bill from his wallet. "No thanks," I said. "Well, anyway, I brought them along and they need to get out of the boxes." He lifted the pups down one at a time. The one was an absolute twin to the sister I'd brought home. Such a pretty little guy. He turned out to be the best upland hunting dog I ever kept, ever hunted over, period. Required no training. Seemed, without fail, to understand everything I asked of him, was affectionate and loyal, as perfect a partner as I could have wished, and I got my $100 back besides. A human life can be measured in many ways. A hunter and a country dweller, I can measure mine in the lives of the dogs I've kept, those whose impressions I've shared here, and others besides. Our canine pals, if we're to have right relations with them, when first they come to us and for as long as we keep them, require devotion and attention and affection and commitment and generosity and patience and fairness and forgiveness and forbearance and gratitude, the very qualities that make any partnership durable and worthy. My newest pup will require all of these of me and more. But isn't it a wonder how these non-human creatures, descendants of wild wolves, though they complicate our lives, can make them also, for those of us who love them, much richer and inspire us to be more human.
Thanks to Matthew Miltich and to Marsh Muirhead, Carol Hepikoski, Rebecca Zemanski, Janet Jiskra, Dave Chase, Robert Jevney, and Diane Korda for sharing their friends with us today on Stay Human. I'm Michael Goldberg, back this time next week with another hour of story and song for spirit and courage.
If dogs run free, then what must be, and that is all. True love can make a blade of grass stand up straight and tall. In harmony with a cosmic sea, true love needs no company. It can cure the soul, it can make it whole. If dogs run free, ba 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 ba.